At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Mr. Apple.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome back to Heard Tell. Okay, we're going to go back over yonder, the UK, our friends over there. We haven't checked in with them for a while because we've had a bit of a hot mess going on right here at home, but they got one of them going there too. So let's go to Oliver Dean, president of Hayek Society over there. He goes to the London School of Economics. If you don't know what that is, kids, go look it up. They just let you wander in off the street. You got to be pretty smart. And he is smart. He's been doing all kinds of commentary for our old friends, Young Voices over there. Oliver, how are you, sir? Appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for having me on. Pleasure to be here.
Thrilled to have you. Let's start big picture for the American audience because we've been a little busy and we haven't been paying attention to our UK friends quite so much. We'll get into these individually, but there's a lot of issues for an outside observer that I'm watching here. And we covered the election and we know Keir Starmer rose and we know the Conservatives kind of collapsed and we know reform is on the rise. When you see headlines like the youth vote, like the economic stuff, like the Palestine stuff, like the migrant stuff, big picture wise, before you get into all their individual merits, this really looks like a Labour government that is flailing, has never really found its footing, and is just bouncing from thing to thing to thing to try to figure out what sticks. Is that an unfair assessment of what's really going on, big picture wise?
No, I'd agree with you completely. This is been the case for this Labour government since it came into office. And it's actually quite surprising because the polls suggested from as early as 2022 that Labour were going to come in with a landslide majority with a couple of hundred seats in Parliament. And so you would have thought that their policy teams, their advisory teams would have prepared for this, would have prepared to come into government and hit the ground running. And yet what we've seen is the complete opposite of that. Almost from day one, this government has been marked by crisis after crisis, mistake after mistake. And as a result of that, we're seeing, you know, the rise of, as you said, reform in the polls. We're seeing people lose confidence in Labour, not just ordinary voters. Businesses are losing confidence in this government. Its own MPs are losing confidence in this government. We've seen that through a number of different votes and other types of scandals recently. And so, yeah, I think it is definitely the case that this government doesn't actually have a clear direction. It's just running from fire to fire, trying to put each one out rather than tackling the main root issues at play here.
And just so we can do a bit of a review for the American and international audience that maybe didn't keep up with it, you know, Reader's Digest version. The review of this is the Conservatives were in power for 14 years. It got really messy at the end. They were just running through prime ministers. Normally, that means Labour comes in, and traditionally in the modern era, when the out-of-power party comes in, they usually get at least one full election and then the next election before things get really ugly. This has been different, not just because of the Conservative collapse, and you could go back to the Boris Johnson stuff when that really started and then what happened after that. Reform is on the rise, and Labour, you explain it to me. Are they caught in the middle between two things and don't know how to triangulate? Did they just assume that Conservative down, we would be out and didn't put the work in? What happened there? Because this is a bit of an anomaly in modern UK politics that we're living in right now.
Yeah, and it's quite strange because, you know, this is a two-party system that has existed for however many hundreds of years. And this is a once in a generational shift. We saw it, you know, in the 1920s when Labour became the dominant second party. And what we're quite possibly seeing now is Reform becoming the most as the second dominant party. But I think, you know, it goes to that point that the Conservatives were in power for 14 years. They had the opportunity to set things straight, to make things right. And because of their failure after 14 years, voters turned around and said, okay, well, we're going to give Labour a chance. And as I said earlier, had Labour hit the ground running, had they started properly and made good progress with good policies in key areas that mattered to people, then I think we'd be looking at a very different electoral landscape than we are currently. But because Labour have failed, you know, so miserably, so quickly, voters are turning around and saying, well, why would we want either the Conservatives who we've had in for 14 years who just mess it up, or a Labour government that hasn't benefited anybody in their first year of government? Why would we want that? Why would we not just go for an outside party? And it challenges this preconceived notion that a lot of commentators have, which is that reform are just this, you know, right-wing party that the Conservatives, but a bit further to the right. That couldn't be further from the truth. Reform are an all-encompassing party, and we saw that in local elections where they were taking seats and councils off of Labour strongholds. And this is just a complete shake-up of the political system, and it's going to be interesting to see the general election in 2029 as to how this all plays out.
And part of that interesting part is, and I want to be fair here, because it's easy for us to just go on TV and dunk on people. And sometimes they deserve it. And Labour deserves it. And the Conservatives deserve it. And when we criticize reform, they usually deserve it as well. However, there's some systemic issues in the UK right now that, and it was very interesting when we covered the election, how many people we talked to of our friends that were very pessimistic that even bringing Labour in instead of Conservative, and they were just like, we don't really think this will change anything, but we just want to kind of settle things down. There really was some pessimism because of some of the systemic problems going on, the economic problems, the housing crisis, the immigration issues, NHS. You can pick your issue. There's a very pessimistic stream to UK politics beyond just the typical stereotypic British, we're grumpy about things. Is that unfair to say?
No, I think that's fairly fair to say. And again, it goes to the point that we had a Conservative-led government for 14 years, and they were faced with these issues, like you said, whether it be the NHS, whether it be housing, whether it be migration. And they were given numerous opportunities and numerous mandates to solve those issues, and yet they just didn't do it. And what we're seeing a lot of the time from different governments of different parties is that they just throw money at the problem, or they throw Band-aid solutions or sticker plaster solutions at the problem, and they don't actually try to fix the long-term issues. And so, for example, what we're seeing with the NHS, nobody in the UK is in denial that the NHS needs some type of reform. Now, what that reform looks like, we don't know. But successive governments have just repeatedly thrown money at the issue, and they said, well, if we just increase yearly funding to the NHS this year, then our problems will be solved. And as every year has gone by, the problems have just gotten worse, and we're spending more and more money. And it's just this black hole of finances that we just keep pouring money into, and nothing seems to get better. And so I think that, again, is part of the appeal as to why people are turning away from this traditional two-party system, because none of it has worked for this the last few years. And another party is coming along and saying, okay, well, we're going to change up the system completely. We're not going to do things conventionally. And that's appealing to a lot of people who feel as though, you know, the political establishment has left them behind.
Yeah, there's polling out now. I will link to this and we'll put it on the show notes at the Substack. In 2011, so going back that 14 years of Conservative, 2011, the number one issue polling as far as just people wanting what they cared about, the economy, was almost 80% of that polling. And then immigration, asylum, most important, was around 50%. And then you get down to health, NHS, that sort of thing, about 30%. Crime at about 20%, give or take. And then a couple other things, defense and security, the environment, things like that were bumping along down in the single digits. Fast forward to today. This is shocking. The economy's 55% say that's the most important issue, but the immigration and asylum issue is up to 46. Those lines have crisscrossed back and forth over the last 18 months looking at this chart. And health is up to about 35 after going down and then spiking back up. And crime is up over 20%. And the environment has gone down to where they're barely talking about it. And defense and security has bumped up and down. And that's almost exactly in line with world events like the Russia-Ukraine war, Palestine, things like that always pops it up. This is a shocking change in less than a generation of, no, we really want to talk about this immigration issue, even at the expense of the economy. And I'm going to phrase it to you this way, because this is the sticky point of always talking about politics and immigration and the economy. They all go together. But politically, the way you talk about it is you split them up as separate issues.
Yeah.
And you're seeing a lot of that in the UK right now, where they're trying to treat the economy like a policy. They're treating immigration like a policy. But the culture war, social media side of it, is putting that all together. And then that's why that number's moving that way.
Yeah. And I think a lot of this comes down to Brexit and the 2015 election. People were promised during that time that we were going to take back control. We were going to get control of our borders. And then when Boris Johnson came in, he promised to implement an Australian point style system to immigration. And again, the Conservatives promised year after year that they were going to cut net migration. I think David Cameron at one point promised that he would get it down to the tens of thousands. And yet now we're seeing it in the hundreds of thousands. And I think it was an LBC interview a few weeks ago, but a former Conservative minister who worked in the Home Office came out and said it was an accident and a mistake that they let migration get out of control. And I think the truth of the matter is that the Conservatives realized, and this goes to your point about the economy, the Conservatives realized how important migration was to the economy. After COVID especially, we realized how difficult our economic output was becoming, how stagnant it was becoming. And they attempted to fix that through increasing migration, yet telling the public that they were going to get a control on migration. So like you said, these all come together, and it's, you know, quite wrong, I would say, for people in the media, people in politics, to try and separate these issues out when actually they're all interconnected with each other.
And we also know immigration is a hot button issue that brings out the good, the bad, and the ugly in folks. When you put the economy with it, when you put an uncertain political environment in it, you have yourself a powder keg. And we could just bang on the headlines, but just talk through as somebody that's actually in the UK, because we just go from news story to news story to news story. This is very much a build thing. You talked about Brexit. There was the COVID lockdown stuff also. People just have a fundamental lack of faith in government. And then you have the chaos of the last few years. And now you have a new administration that's come in and has never found its footing. I think that's a fair way to lay it out. There's a lot of people behaving badly, but this is cumulative. This did not happen in a vacuum. This happened in a sequence of events, and it's trending in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that particularly recently. So in Essex, there were a number of protests against migrant housing, against providing people who are crossing the channel with hotels, for example, and accommodation. And it's quite easy to look at that and say, well, this is just, you know, symptomatic of these channel crossings and nothing more. But like you pointed out, this has been a long-term process. People are becoming increasingly fed up with government and their actions. Again, if governments are promising to cut legal migration, for example, whether you believe that that's a good thing or a bad thing, if a government's promising to do it and they're failing to deliver on that promise, people are going to be annoyed at that. And again, we saw it in 2024, the summer of 2024, with the Southport riots. Essentially, basically a crazed man walked into a Taylor Swift-themed dance class that had I think it was about 30 or 40 children in it who were dancing, and then he went on a frenzy and stabbed loads of them. He killed three of them, and this set off a lot of anti-migrant rhetoric, a lot of anti-migrant protests, because people believed that he was outside of the UK. In actuality, he was born in Cardiff. But again, that goes to that point about misinformation, about disinformation being spread. People seize on that, and then they'll use any opportunity, and that spread protests and riots across the UK. And again, it's this boiling pot almost that has been boiling for a long time, and we're seeing it come to fruition now.
Let's talk about some individual issues real quick and go through this. This Online Safety Act has become a... What word do you want to use that's in the British parlance? Because it's probably night. Omni-shambles is one of those UK words I really, really like. Debacles. On a scale of bit of trouble, as the UK would say, all the way up to omni-shambles, which pick your example of that one, where on the scale are we? Because I don't think this has gone the way proponents or opponents have thought this was going to go.
Yeah, I put this beyond an omni-shambles. This is just a complete joke. It's a complete mess. And it's at the point now where we're seeing cross-party opposition to this legislation. So Owen Jones, who was a former member of the Labour Party, I think he left a few months ago. He's quite a big name in left-wing politics here in the UK. And Nigel Farage, who is the leader of Reform UK, are both in agreement that this is a terrible piece of legislation. The government's argument towards it is that it's going to protect... Sorry, yeah, go on.
Those two don't agree on anything. So for them, background on that, sorry to interrupt you.
No, absolutely. Like you said, they don't agree on anything. And so the fact that they've actually found some common ground in opposing this legislation just shows you how much the government has messed up in this sense. And the point that the government is trying to put across is that this is going to protect children specifically by restricting access to certain content, particularly pornography. Essentially, when you would go onto a porn site now, you would be asked to provide some type of identity check to validate your identity and prove that you're over the age of 18. What the government hasn't realized is that VPNs exist, so people can just get around this within the space of about 30 seconds. And it's also worrying because a lot of these sites, if you're uploading your data to these sites, there's nothing to stop online hackers or criminals from obtaining this data, using this to blackmail you, using this to exploit you. And so the government's excuse that this is just to protect children and people online, in fact, it's doing the complete opposite of that.
Not only that, but the internet moves a lot faster than governments do. So people move pretty quick. And look, the porn thing is what grabs the headlines. And for the children has been the excuse to do all sorts of things over the years, always will be. You know, I was told for the children we had to ban Snoop Dogg and he just hosted the Olympics. So, you know, for the children has its lifespans. What the internet did really quickly, though, is they started showing all the pretty mundane sites that were getting blocked. Hmm. And they start mocking you. And then they start showing, you know, the internet is pretty much undefeated. It's faster. It's more agile. This is one of those things where government just looks incompetent because, as a lot of people pointed out, it's like, do you not understand VPNs exist? Do you not understand that, you know, the Communist Party of China tried to enforce this with way more ability than any Western government will ever have, thank God, at least for the moment, to enforce this? They can't enforce them. They can't even keep kids from playing video games on grandma's account. That's the problem they're having with the age restrictions. This isn't going to work. Everybody knows it's not going to work, but they're doing it anyway under the guise of children and pornography. And we all understand that what this really is a data issue, an identity issue. Why did they push ahead with this when everybody knew it wasn't going to work?
So this is the question, and it's actually rather strange because just a few weeks ago, the government was talking about how young people should be entrusted to vote in our democracy, should be entrusted, you know, to go to the ballot box and choose who they want to be leading their country. And now we're seeing them turn around and say, actually, no, they can't be trusted to watch pornography online. And again, we saw it in the first few weeks of this government when it first came to power. They pushed through with the generational tobacco ban, which essentially bans anybody born after the 1st of January 2009 from ever being able to smoke a traditional tobacco product. And so it's rather hypocritical and paradoxical from this government to turn around and say, well, we're going to trust young people in one sense, but then take away their responsibilities and their freedoms in another sense. But like you said, I just think the government is so short-sighted and doesn't actually understand why it's doing this or how it's actually supposed to be implemented. And you mentioned VP.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And there was a BBC article that reported one particular VPN supplier saw an increase in download of 1,800% the day after the legislation was brought into action. So clearly people are just avoiding this. And some people in the government, and there are rumors circulating around Westminster, that the government is actually going to then launch an attack on VPNs as well, which if that happens, it's just completely crazy. And I wouldn't know what to say at that point. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, but it's just complete insanity. And I really don't understand what the government's intentions are behind this. They're turning around and saying that they're protecting children when, in actuality, they're just taking away their rights and their freedoms.
Speaking of rights and freedoms, another one that's been going around is dropping the youth vote to the age of 16. Now, actually, all my children are older than 16 now because my youngest is getting ready to turn 18. God help us all. In the UK, correct me if I'm wrong, at 16, you actually don't have a lot of freedoms. You can't do a whole lot of things. You can't smoke. You can't technically own things. You can't vote, you can't serve in the military, you can't drink, you can't do, that list goes long and long and long. But that demographic is leans more labor, so labor is floating, giving them the vote. Again, big picture wise as an analysis, I'm going, this is just something you throw against the wall when nothing else is working and you want people to talk about what's not working. So I understand that. But if you took the policy on the face of it, it feels ridiculous. It looks ridiculous. Is there any chance this is going to be anything other than a big social media blow up and a political distraction?
No, I don't think it is. And the justification that the government has put behind this is that, well, 16 and 17 year olds are able to work and pay taxes, and therefore they should have a right to say where those taxes go. However, the data just reveals a completely different story. We've seen it. About 30%, I think it's 33% of 16 to 17 year olds are working in some capacity, whether that be full-time or part-time, and therefore paying taxes on that income, compared to roughly 60% of 18 year olds. So this argument that, well, because they're able to pay taxes and work, that they should be able to vote, doesn't actually hold water because the majority of them are not doing that. But to go to the point you mentioned about how this is just, you know, political gerrymandering in some capacity, I don't think that that's an insane observation to make, an unworldly observation to make. We've seen time and again, election after election, you know, 18 to 24 year olds specifically are much more likely to vote Labour than other age groups. We know that the majority of 16 and 17 year olds, there were a number of mock elections done during 2024 to see how schools would actually vote. And we've seen that the vast, vast majority of them ended up returning some type of Labour government. Now, combining this with the fact that teachers are going to obviously be providing this education, there is a substantial risk that that impartiality of teaching politics is going to be lost. And again, we know that the majority of teachers vote Labour. So there is, like I say, a significant worry that this is going to create an echo chamber where teachers who are already supporting Labour are going to turn around to students who are much more likely to support Labour and tell them to vote for Labour. And this could, in fact, change the electoral outcome in 2029. We don't yet know. But like you said as well, there are a number of things that 16 and 17-year-olds aren't allowed to do. And the government has just taken away their right to, for example, watch pornography, to smoke tobacco. And yet we're also supposed to believe that we can trust them to make an informed decision when it comes to voting. It one and one aren't making two.
Yeah, Oliver Dean joining us. I think one thing that's missing in the youth vote and in the housing crisis, which disproportionately affects, you know, young adults trying to get into the market and moving up, and a lot of the political turmoil, I think, underneath that, when you talk to folks in the UK of a certain age, and we do because you're a Young Voices contributor and the young get dealt with this, there's a real broiling issue with the UK higher education university system right now that's not getting covered a lot. Now, the UK and England especially's university system has kind of been the envy of the world for most of the last 60, 70 years. But we have seen now there's data coming out for the first time in over a decade, foreign students is dropping. There is a disconnect between getting that university degree and getting into the labor force. there is a lot of funding problems. And if you go up to places like Scotland, it's even worse than it is in England. Of course, there's four nations making up the UK. There's a big problem going on inside of the university system. If you're going to talk about the upheaval of the youth vote, and you're going to talk about the problems with the youth trying to find jobs and the economy and the housing crisis, I think the missing piece of this is, does the university system in the UK fit the modern UK? And that discussion is starting to really ripple up underneath a lot of this political stuff. You're that age group. You're going through that. Explain it to us.
So this all started, I would argue, with Tony Blair when he tried to push more and more young people to go to university. And what we see in a lot of secondary schools and a lot of sixth form colleges is teachers will turn to young people and say, well, you know, if you just go to university, if you go for 3 years and you get a degree, then you're going to have a well-paid job when you come out. You'll be able to enter the labor market and you'll be earning a very good wage. A lot of people aren't dealing with that reality. A lot of young people are going to university when, in actuality, university doesn't necessarily suit them, whether that be because of the profession that they want to go into, whether that be because of the grades that they obtained at A-level. And there is this type of illusion that just because you go to even fairly decent universities, you know, we're talking Russell Group universities, and that you're going to end up with a good paid job at the end of it. Again, it's not true. Your people are going for jobs, and I discussed this on an interview with GB News, actually. People are going for jobs where there are more than 400 applicants for a single place. And when you've got these universities that aren't actually equipping you with real world knowledge, with the real skills that you need for the workplace, when I think it was the statistic was 50% of young people aged 18 to 24 don't feel prepared to enter the world of work. When this is the case, you have to be asking, well, you know, what are these universities actually doing? It's okay if their purpose is to provide academic insights and provide academic learning and providing academic environment for people to then go on to, you know, academic jobs. But if people are being told constantly that actually we're sending people to university so they can get the skills they need for a well-paid job afterwards, then I think we need to face that lie head on and tell people the truth, which is that that's not the case anymore.
Yeah, let's finish up with reform real quick. I don't want to get into the ins and outs of the politics of it because I think the big picture part of this is a little more interesting. And we're going to look, we know the way this is going. At some point, reform is probably going to get a turn at the wheel, whether it's a called election in the next year or two, 2029, whatever the situation is. My outside opinion, and just because we've all seen history, is groups like reform, they work really, really great in opposition. And then once they get their turn at the wheel and they get into power themselves, especially a new party whose actual structure is a little bit questionable, and I don't mean that in a good or bad way, it's just it's new and they don't have the infrastructure the old parties do. When and if reform gets a majority and gets a prime minister and gets in the power in the House, they're not going to automatically get buys on any of the ongoing issues. In fact, they're probably going to have more pressure on them because they're expressly getting there to fix them. Do you see reform having a viable path to fixing some of these problems, or is the rhetoric just going to run into a brick wall and we get more of a mess? Project this out a couple of years beyond just the noise of right now, where you think reform is going.
To be completely honest with you, I don't know. And a few months ago, when people would ask me this, I would say reform are in no way a serious party of government. But I know from sources within reform that they're stepping up their policy making machine. They've got people inside the party who are coming up with actual meaningful policies. So that would make me think, to some extent, maybe there is an argument saying that they are actually prepared for government. But the counter to that argument, which is what people up and down the country are talking about, is that the policies that they are coming out with are simply ridiculous. So a few months ago, Nigel Farage established his economic plan and his financial plan for a possible reform government, and he wanted to propose a number of changes. So, for example, raising the minimum rate of income tax from what it currently is at about £12,000 per year to £20,000, raising the top level of income tax, removing the two-child benefit cap, restoring winter fuel allowance, etc., etc. And overall, these spending commitments amounted to about £80 to £90 billion. Yet at the same time, the cuts that he was proposing, so for example, to DEI, to asylum seekers, to asylum seekers claiming hotels, for example, to net zero costs, all of these things actually amount to roughly £20 billion, if that. So this is a party that's claiming to be a serious contender for government, and yet is coming up with tens of billions of pounds of unspended tax breaks, of unspended tax cuts. And if those are the economic policies that this party is coming out with, then I think we just have to turn around and say that they're not necessarily a serious party for government, and they're not a serious contender for government.
And if that happens, then where does it leave us? Because if you have a third party, look, third parties come and go over history anytime you have a two-party system, whether it's the US or the UK. Is there any way that that happens that doesn't end up with everything being worse than it currently is now? Because just historically looking, if you have a populist party, for lack of a better term, rise up, we're going to fix it, we don't fix it, they recede back, there's no way that ends better than where we are now, right?
I mean, yes and no. I think there's an argument to saying that in the event that reform do come to power and they mess up as badly as I'm anticipating them to mess up, then people are going to turn around and say, well, maybe it's these centrist parties that we've had for the last few hundred years, maybe they're not so bad and maybe we should return to them. But at the same time, you know, I just really do not believe that this is a serious party for government, that they're a good party for government. And, you know, it's often the case with populist parties that they're reliant on sound bites and not actual policies. It's one thing for Nigel Farage and Richard Tice and others to turn around and say, well, we're going to solve this problem, this problem, this problem. It's this easy. If it was that easy, would previous governments not have already accomplished this? And I think they're going in with these rose-tinted glasses, believing that things will be much easier for them than they actually are. And I think in the event that they do win the election, they're going to be faced with that reality. And people are going to see reform for what they really are, which is just a party that's built on soundbites and not actual policy.
Political question based off of that, then. There's been some polling, there's been some discussion, especially since the last round of council elections here, week or so ago. There's some concern that reform, and I've heard people that are very pro-reform talking about this privately, that they're starting to top out in polling a little bit, that they're about as popular as they can possibly get. Is there discussion of is this as popular as they're going to get because of infrastructure? There's, of course, Nigel Farage is a very controversial figure. There's people that say even if he found a way to Downing Street, he would have a pretty hard ceiling on how much support he's going to get just because of his career and so forth. Is there a discussion that the Reform Party as it currently exists may be at the kind of the peak it's going to be, that if it's going to take that next step to a serious party, and they're starting to get some serious people flip over to them, and if they got power, they'd get even more because that's just politics. Is there a discussion that it's going to have to be the next generation and the next crop of reform, not necessarily the one that brought it to the fore, for it to be more than what it is now?
Yes, and I think that's not necessarily too crazy of an idea to believe in or an idea to take forward. Even, you know, the Conservative and Labour Party, when they're topping out polling numbers, when they're at the top of the polls, they normally sit anywhere from between 30% and 40%, and that's exactly where Reform is sitting now. It's very rare, I think, with the exception of maybe Tony Blair or maybe Margaret Thatcher, that these parties will ever reach more than 40% of the popular votes, or, you know, the projected seats. So the fact that Reform is sitting at about 30% to 35% makes me think that that's, you know, the highest that they're going to achieve. Now, we are seeing with the creation of, for example, Jeremy Corbyn's new party — they don't yet have a name for it, but Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana have established a new party, which is supposed to rival the Labour vote. That, again, paves the way for a Reform victory in 2029. If Labour's vote splits and these hard left voters are going to turn to Jeremy Corbyn's party and vote for them instead of Labour, it's going to open a door for Reform to just walk straight in. And so when you're combining that with these polling numbers, with the popularity that we're seeing across the country, with the success in local elections, it's looking as though Reform are gaining momentum. And it's actually a case of, you know, when is this momentum going to stop?
Yeah, I was really hoping we were done with the Jeremy Corbyn coverage, but alas, we are doomed, apparently. Oliver Dean, fantastic insight. Really appreciate it. I want to leave with this, though. You've actually worked on mayoral campaigns. You've done a little bit of politics. You do the analysis thing. Now you're a talking head on TV. Congratulations on that. Give folks one or two things from over across the pond or the international audience of what to watch for besides the news, because the news cycle now is basically reform versus labor versus conservative. That's the main story, and everything's going to spin off of that, the immigration and everything else. Yeah. Give folks one or two things to actually be watching for. Is it an economic data point? Is it a foreign policy point? Is it an immigration point? Give us one or two things so when they see the dent of the headline, they can go, oh, nope, that's the one I need to pay attention to.
Yeah. I think it's actually quite difficult to pinpoint one thing exactly, but what I would say is that instead of looking at the headlines, instead of looking at what you see on TV, if you have the opportunity to talk to someone from the UK, just one-on-one, and you ask them what their issues are, that will provide you so much more insight than anything else that you can ever imagine. And what we've seen from this idea of the Westminster bubble, where people in Westminster are so insulated from the rest of the UK, is that people are becoming disaffected with that. And when you see that, like you said, when I worked on mayoral campaigns, when I worked on parliamentary campaigns, knocking on doors and talking to people and actually hearing their issues. And some of these things, you know, like you were mentioning earlier with these polling numbers, we're seeing economic issues, the NHS, immigration top these polls. But for a lot of people, it can be, you know, local issues. It can be the condition of their roads, whether their bins get collected once a week, twice a week, whatever. There are so many like smaller issues that lie beneath the surface and that lie below the headlines that actually impact a lot of people much more than these, you know, big headline issues. And so I'd urge people to, you know, consider that and think about that when they see these headlines in the news.
Yep. And that's why when we talk about the UK, we bring on actual people from the UK. What a concept for American television. Oliver Dean, appreciate your time. Let folks know where they can follow you, because we're definitely going to have you back, buddy. We'll talk some more, because we have some pretty serious stuff coming up this fall in the UK that we're going to have to be discussing when you look long term. Let us know how we can follow you until we get you back on, my friend.
Yeah. So I'm on Twitter under the handle The Ollie Dean. I'll probably put out a tweet mentioning this later on, so you'll probably be able to find that there. If not, LinkedIn as well. If you search Young Voices on YouTube, you'll be able to see some of my previous clips. So yeah, you can find me all on those.
The Ollie and Andy Show, that's got a ring to it. We might have to pitch that to Sky News or somebody. Oliver Dean, outstanding insight, my friend. You have yourself a lovely evening over there. We'll talk to you again soon, sir.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Andrew.
All the music on Her Tell is provided under a creative content license from MonsterCat.com. Somos la máquina.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.